I'd like to call the Jobs and Economic Development Committee to order for Wednesday, the 27th. For all of those that are here and the regulars here, not all of you, I'm going to embarrass my CA.
What?
I'm going to embarrass my CA. Well, I could have done it tomorrow. I could do it again tomorrow. But tomorrow is his last day. He has the joyful experience of adopting two young children, 2 years old. I'm not sure if it's a good thing he adopted them at 2 years old, so he missed all that little stuff, you know, with wrapping them in burrito wraps and stuff, or he went straight to almost done with the potty training.
Mm-hmm. Terrible twos.
The terrible twos?
Yeah.
Oh, my kids were perfect. I never had that.
Three acres.
So congratulations, Tim.
I'll be back in 3 weeks.
You'll be back in 3 weeks when we get to our conference committee. But
and we're going to have a special session, so he'll be fine.
Oh.
So is Representative Schultz here? Oh, how about Representative Olson? Are you doing the Wisconsin, the Duluth bill?
Yep.
All right. Well, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
And
just mine?
We'll do the minutes in a little bit. Would you like to say something, or would you like to move this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd really enjoy moving House File 1216.
House File 1216 is on the table. To be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment to an author's amendment to move. Can someone move that as well to get the bill in the shape?
We'll only move those bills if you understand that we are trying to move briefly tonight because we all want to be home by 9.
Okay, understood.
Representative Sundin, would you care to move an amendment or two?
I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chair. The
19. The A-19 amendment? You don't have 1216?
I have it here somewhere.
Which one are we looking at?
A-19.
Okay. So he, Representative Sundin has moved the A-19. What's the other one? You said you had two?
No, Mr. Chair, just the one amendment.
Just the one. It's small enough that we'll move it and keep it in, get it in your bill, get your shape you want. All those in favor of the A-19 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You've got the bill in the way you want it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for taking the time to hear House File 1216 today. And I'm here on behalf of Representative Schultz, who has fallen victim to the sickness that seems to be plaguing SOB. So I'm here on her behalf, and this is a bill that she's carried and done a lot of work on, so I want to give credit to her for that work she's done, and I know she wishes she could be here. So the City of Duluth, Essentia Health, and St. Luke's Hospital have been working together on the largest economic redevelopment opportunity in the city's history. Essentia Health is investing over $800 million in a new hospital and ancillary medical facility. St. Luke's is also investing upwards to $200 million in a new and updated facilities on their campus. These substantial private investments will change the face of the East Hillside of Duluth, providing opportunities for investment in housing and commercial ventures on land that is currently used for surface parking or occupied by old, outdated buildings. House File 1216 looks to leverage these historic private investments to obtain public infrastructure funding from the state to take advantage of this rare redevelopment opportunity. I have with me tonight officials from the City of Duluth, Essentia Health, St. Luke's Hospital, and the Duluth Building Trades to provide more information about this exciting opportunity and to answer questions you may have. So with that, I will turn it over to Noah Schuckman from the City of Duluth.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Noah Schuckman. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the City of Duluth. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Schultz's bill, House File 1216, and I also appreciate Representative Olson's willingness to present the bill tonight. As you've just heard from Representative Olson, both Essentia and St. Luke's are making significant investments in their campuses in Duluth. The public infrastructure provided in this legislation will help support the modernization of our medical institutions and will change the face of the city's East Hillside. This part of the city struggles with very old housing stock, a patchwork of surface parking lots, and with outdated and dilapidated infrastructure. As Essentia and St. Luke's make these significant investments in their new medical facilities, there will be wonderful opportunities to put previously underutilized land back into productive use. We are excited about the housing and business redevelopment opportunities this legislation will help create in a part of the city that has struggled. We stand in support of Essentia and St. Luke's as they proceed with their exciting new construction projects. We very much appreciate the committee's time and attention to this important development for the city of Duluth, our region, and ultimately the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I understand this is the Jobs Committee, and I want to be sure to express my excitement for the impact this project will have on jobs in our region. Not only will the new hospital help ensure that the high-paying jobs that currently exist at Essentia and St. Luke's are retained, but the construction of the medical facilities and the corresponding public infrastructure will create numerous quality jobs in the construction and building trade industries. In addition to representatives from each hospital system, we also have with us today representatives from the construction and building trade industries to speak further about the construction jobs that will result from this legislation. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
We're going to hold the questions till the end, so please stick around for another 15 minutes or so. Next, we have Mike Mahoney.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Michael Mahoney. I am the Vice President of Public Policy for Essentia Health. Thank you for the time this evening on your agenda. And thank you to both Representative Schultz and Representative Olson for your leadership on this pursuit and for co-authoring House File 1216, which supports significant economic development in downtown Duluth, the basis of which builds upon Essentia's historic $800 million private investment as we modernize and consolidate our downtown Duluth campus. Before you should have a packet of materials summarizing the comments that I make today. And it's entitled Vision Northland. Essentia Health is the largest private employer north of the Twin Cities and consists of 15 hospitals, 74 clinics across northern Minnesota, northwest Wisconsin, and northeast North Dakota. Essentia Health employs more than 14,500 individuals across our service area and more than 6,700 in the Twin Ports alone. We are headquartered in Duluth with a significant presence downtown consisting of multiple clinic sites and two hospitals, St. Mary's Medical Center and the former City Hospital, Miller Dwan Medical Center. Essentia Health's mission is we are called to make a healthy difference in people's lives. As we all know, medicine has and is changing rapidly. Models of care have evolved over time, and Essentia's current Duluth facilities sometimes hinder our delivery of care. At the same time, patient expectations have evolved, and double occupancy rooms are no longer acceptable. Essentia's presence in Duluth dates back to 1888, when the Benedictine Sisters of St. Scholastica Monastery established St. Mary's Hospital, and has remained in its current site since 1898. Since then, it has been renovated, remodeled, and significant additions incorporated to meet the health care needs of the residents of the Northland. Over the past several years, Essentia has undergone the process of identifying how best to meet the needs of the patients we have the privilege to serve. Our objective is to provide the highest level of care with patient safety and satisfaction as the imperative. We also recognize the need for an environment that allows Essentia to recruit and retain industry-leading professionals and address workforce shortages. In short, we need to meet the patient and employee needs that are currently fettered by our current facilities. As a result of this planning, Essentia Health St. Mary's Medical Center is now the region's first and only Level 1 trauma center north of the metropolitan area. As I've stated, our Duluth campus consists of two hospitals, the 380 licensed bed St. Mary's and the 165 licensed bed Miller Dwan Medical Center, the former public hospital of Duluth. Another component of our long-term planning includes Essentia consolidating its downtown campus, consisting currently of many city blocks, to just three city blocks, and to build a new St. Mary's Medical Center bed tower, state-of-the-art ambulatory surgical center, and renovate and add clinical space in connection with St. Mary's and Miller Dwan. The $521 million investment in the new St. Mary's Medical Center, together with an additional $279 million investment in Miller Dwan Medical Center, cumulatively add up to the significant $800 million investment in our Duluth campus. Of additional interest, as Essentia consolidates its campus, there will be significant tax-exempt property returned to the tax roll for additional private development in the future. Essentia has retained McGough Construction as our general contractor, and we estimate 80% of the project contractors and subcontractors will be Minnesota-based. I'm pleased to report we have a project labor agreement in connection with this endeavor. Based on data compiled through the Associated General Contractors of America and supported by an independent outside economist familiar with projects of this magnitude, the economic impact of a project this size will result in 5,680 on-site jobs during the construction phase, which is 3 years, 3,680 off-site but related jobs, and another 11,440 indirect jobs associated with construction supply materials and services, the supermajority from within the state. With me today are lead administrators from St. Mary's Medical Center and Miller Dwan. In the event that there are questions specific to the licensing, credentialing, capacity, and service lines that we provide. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to share with you Essentia's significant plans and the benefits that will accrue to the patients we serve, the city of Duluth, the Arrowhead region, and the state of Minnesota, given a private investment of this scope and magnitude. And I'll be available for questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Sure. Good evening, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Lone. I'm the interim chief executive officer of the St. Luke's Health System in Duluth. I have five slides to go over. They should be in your materials, hopefully. I'll just speak briefly to some of these comments. First of all, St. Luke's Health System is a three-hospital system. We have the St. Luke's Hospital that is located in Duluth, as well as the Two Harbors Hospital, Lakeview, and we also manage the Grand Marais Hospital as well. We have 43 primary and specialty care clinics throughout the region, 9 urgent care and acute care clinics. We are a regional center for heart, vascular, regional cancer center, as well as a trauma center. Established in 1881 as Duluth's first hospital in the city. Just a couple statistics in regards to our growth that we've had in both in patient visits as well as providers. The first slide shows numbers from 2000 to 2018. You can see from a patient care perspective, we've grown about 300% from 200,000 patient visits all the way to past 700,000 patient visits in the last year. As well as on the provider side, we have grown about 500% in that same period of time, employing roughly 50 providers in 2000 all the way up to over 250 providers as of last year. Switching our employees, St. Luke's is obviously very proud of all our employees, and we've seen similar growth in that area as well. You can see that we've almost doubled our employee growth or count in that 18-year period as well, roughly from 1,500 to over 3,000 at this current period of time. We are consistently adding 50 to 75 employees every year. These are well-paying jobs. Our average salaries at St. Luke's is roughly $95,000 per FD, so they're good-paying jobs and growth, like I just mentioned, over the last couple decades. As far as what we're looking at for our campus of the future, the third slide shows a current picture of St. Luke's. You can see Lake Superior off to the north of that, just to orientate yourself. It's a multi-phase approach. We're in the middle of phase one. We've just completed a $50 million project over the last 5 years. That's the building up to the right side there. That's called Building A, and we're just engaging in another $40 million project that will start next month that will complete phase one, adding cath labs, a new emergency department, as well as some other ancillary services for the organization. The reason we're looking at this approximately $250 million expansion is there's many facets of that. One is to improve the patient access, to improve our patient experience, to retain and attract our workforce that we're very proud of, expand our service line capacity. And we're also looking to see if we can connect the campus to Lake Superior and some of the amenities that provides for the residents as well as for the patients and our employees on campus. And overall, just to integrate the community interests into the overall campus development. Switching to the next slide is a rendering of our future project, our future rendering of what we would like our campus to look like as we complete phases two and three. As you can see, the parking structure, which is a component of this bill, is on the left-hand side of that. It would be a public parking structure. We located in that corner of our campus really to drive access to the Lake Superior campus as well, or to the everything that Lake Superior offers, as well as to our campus in general. We would envision having retail space as part of that parking structure on the first floor, as well as a housing component, as you can see modeled in there on the top, bringing in some of the housing component to that neighborhood as well. This is an opportunity zone, our neighborhood, so overall we're really looking to partner with the city, the neighborhood, Essentia, and really creating a medical district that's more cohesive for ourselves as well as the neighbors in general. And as you can see in that drawing two, that does add phases two, which is another surgical expansion, as well as a six-story bed tower, which would be another roughly $150 million project at the end of the third phase that we have here. So again, we'll be open to any questions at the end of the session. So thank you.
Thank you. And Craig Olson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Olson.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Craig Olson. I am president of the Duluth Building Trades Council. We represent 15 construction crafts in the city of Duluth and the surrounding area that have approximately several thousand, I don't have an exact number, but several thousands of men and women that work in the trade. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. As you have heard, this legislation combines over $1 billion of private investment with up to $164 million of public investment to change the landscape of the East Hillside and the city of Duluth. This is an investment par with that of the U.S. Bank Stadium, and is going to happen right in the middle of Duluth. The building trades are very eager and proud to be working, looking forward to working on this project, and we are excited about the prospect of several years of construction and employment for our members. Virtually every one of the trades will be engaged in either building the private medical facilities or replacing and upgrading the public infrastructure, which will serve the medical facilities and the medical district. In addition to the hospital and the clinic facilities, the plan calls for the demolition of buildings within the medical district, which will allow for new commercial and residential development, a continued source of work for the building trades and our members. And our contractors, I should note, they are our partners in this industry as well. Over the course of the build-out of the medical facilities and the broader neighborhood, we will see hundreds of building trades jobs engaged in this construction work. The building trades are also pleased to have a seat on the advisory board to be able to share our perspective as the plan and the public infrastructure is developed and realized. We look for your support in Representative Schultz's bill, and I wanted to, we already heard that there is a project labor agreement, but I want to add that both the facilities, both of our hospitals in the city of Duluth, have been very good partners for our members and our employers who work in those facilities. So I want to thank you for your time tonight, and I'm available for questions if you need any.
I think there might be space for an old retired pipe fitter up there.
There could be.
Yeah, well, especially during June, July, and August,
and we can put you to work.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Geriatric wards on the fourth floor.
Hey, what bill do I have to cut today? Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any other witnesses?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience that would care to comment pro or con on this particular bill? Are there any questions from the members? Seeing none, would Representative Sundin like to renew his motion that House File 1216 be referred to Ways and Means?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
All those in favor of House File 1216 as amended to be passed on to Ways and Means, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm up.
Miss
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, welcome to the committee. Please proceed. And
I think you need to bang the gavel, Mr. Chair. Tell them to be quiet.
Well, they're hearing you from there. So according to the chair, you have to be quiet. So I appreciate that we can hear the chair.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 878 as 878 to Ways and Means, but I have a delete all amendment that did not make the 24-hour rule. It is language that is being used over in the Senate, and I am asking the committee's indulgence in putting this on so that we can have both bills, House version and the Senate version, identical. It's that saves us a little work down the road trying to make this align once we get to the floor. So I hear no objections. I will move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Gunter.
I just have one request that you make it very quickly.
Mr. Chair, I would move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Hassan.
Never mind. I was just asking how I see three bills that says Mahoney, so I was trying to figure out which one we're hearing.
House File 878. So the chair, Mahoney, moves DE2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. The amendment has been adopted.
Mr. Chair, what this amendment, this DE amendment does is this is not the finish of a bunch of work, but it is the progress of a bunch of work. In Minnesota, the owner of the building and the general contractor have something called retainage. They can retain 5% of the total cost of the building. And what that means is if you're a dirt contractor and you go in on the site first and you dig the hole, you don't get paid until the building is up and turned over to the owner, which can sometimes be a year, sometimes be a couple of years. This bill tries to alleviate some of that, not all. What there are 20 associations that support this. There's a few that don't. They've been working on this bill for 2 months, and they have come a long way. The original bill called for payment within 30 days of completion of your work. This bill, this delete all amendment, calls for payment within 60 days of completion of the building. There's a number of others, but I will try to be very, very brief and call up the witnesses because they want to go home too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have Mike. We have Irene Cao first with League of Minnesota Cities. She was around here a few minutes ago.
Yeah,
Mike is next. Mike Schechter, please come to the table and state your name and proceed, please.
Thank you very much. I'm Mike Schechter. I work with the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. I've had the chance to represent both contractors and subcontractors. I understand the issue of retainage. It's a very old problem. The historical solution to a number of problems with construction that are somewhat unique to construction has been creating retainage. And on the margins, there are abuses to retainage. We're pleased that the legislature is looking at this and is finding ways to address it. It is a very, very complicated issue, and we understand that this language is a huge step forward. I think that there's a few more things that need to be worked out. Just a couple pieces that if we got into the weeds, you go, oh, yeah, that's a little confusing, but I think that it's nearly there, and we're very happy that you're giving the time to it.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I don't see Ms. Kyle around. Is there any other person who wants to testify on this bill? Someone is coming down. Good evening and welcome. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Julie Byrell. I work for the Department of Administration. We recognize that retainage is an important tool to ensure projects are completed and contract obligations are fully met. Our projects are funded with taxpayer dollars, and we're responsible as stewards of those dollars to make sure what is paid for is received. We value our partnership with contractors and subcontractors to take care of public facilities, and we understand the importance of prompt payment to all parties, including small businesses and targeted vendor groups. We track our prompt payment and have a good record. It's not perfect, but we work to fix problems as soon as issues are identified. However, even at today's retainage, it can be a struggle to get projects fully completed and necessary paperwork submitted. The cost of these incomplete items, in many cases, would greatly exceed the limits that are outlined in the bill. Other tools such as suspension and debarment are available, but they're very punitive and have potential unintended consequences for contractors. Public owners have proposed language to help address payment to early-on subcontractors that have fully met contract obligations and also set specific requirements for when retainage is paid, and we prefer that language over the DE2 amendment. The provision to require all retainage to be paid out 60 days after substantial completion is problematic. Substantial completion is when owners can begin to occupy a building, but that is not final completion, and often we are working with contractors to try and finish those punch list items, anything that's in dispute, maybe, you know, an alarm system is not working, and also to get those final paperwork documents turned in, blueprints, as-built documents, owner's manuals, and also a prevailing wage and payroll documents that are required by law. The 250% amount is challenging. It can be very difficult to determine potential cost because sometimes problems are due to multiple issues involving many subcontractors. Additionally, the $10,000 limit is likely not enough to ensure that the paperwork, final paperwork, is turned in.
Thank you so much. Seeing no any other testified, do we have any questions for Chair Mahoney? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chair Mahoney. I like a lot of things about this bill, but I just had a question. My understanding from some of the contractors I've heard from in my district is that on the private side of this, sometimes the banks are the ones who hold the retainage and have very specific rules about when they will approve letting it go. And also, so could you just speak to how this interfaces with the bank relationship and their requirements for keeping it or letting it go? And also, will this make it harder for private contractors to get credit with a bank to do the projects?
I'll answer the first question, the last question first. I don't know banking that well, but I don't see why it would create a problem with the bank. But I'm sure if a bank wanted to, they can always find some kind of a reason or a problem or something. And, you know, they may not like the contractor, they may not like the project, they may whatever. And it could be difficult, could add difficulties to the financing, yes, for some way or another. And the other one was...
Representative Robbins.
So sorry. You know, I don't fully understand it myself, but I was shown some of these banking agreements with mm-hmm. the... person they're giving the money to, and so how will this impact what the bank is requiring of the person getting the credit, the contractor?
Jim Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand it, the banks, there's final paperwork that typically has to be done, which documents whether you were required to pay prevailing wage. Sometimes you have minority quotas on the job and that you fulfilled. So a variety of those type paperwork pieces are sometimes talked about by the banks. I will tell you a tale that if you've ever worked in construction, you probably know it, that it's everybody else's problem but yours. So they point to the bank, or they point to the general contractor, or they point to the subcontractor, or they point to the, you know, the bookkeeper or the subcontractor. What is happening is that we have $8 billion worth of construction in this metro area, and they get to retain 5%. That's a lot of money. And what this bill is trying to do is shrink that. And one of the reasons, one of the pieces in here, and people keep coming back for the paperwork, they put a $10,000 hold on it. Now, that might not be a whole lot to Krauss Anderson, but to Tom's Mechanical, yeah, that's a bunch. That might be the profit or profit plus on a particular project. And if you're a most of these jobs have a large general, and then they have a mechanical, and that can entail two or three different types of construction. So it could be the sheet metal, the pipe fitting, the plumbing, and they all get smaller as they get spread out, and they all get to hold on to that 5% until they're comfortable, and then they get to pay everybody off. So what we're trying to do is hold that $10,000 for, you know, the value of to make sure the paperwork gets done. In the punch list, you're holding 2.5% in some of these after 75% completion. So it keeps getting, as the list gets smaller, the retainage gets smaller, and that's what we're trying to do. I don't know if I answered it, roundabout way.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Any other questions from the members? Represent me.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Mahoney, does this bring us in compliance with the Senate version?
With the what? The Senate version?
Senate version?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Micklin. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. For Mr. Chair, I'm going to give you the final words.
Good bill, vote for it.
So, Mr. Chair renews his motion for House File 878 as amended to be re-referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. Mr. Chair, you're on your way.
Chair and committee members.
Representative Moran, your bill is next.
Back to me already. Representative Moran, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2413 for possible inclusion in the jobs omnibus bill.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2413 will allow for completion of a bill out of commercial spaces in the Selby Milton Vittorio project on Selby Avenue in the Rondo community. The Rondo Trust Community Land Trust has secured $160,000 with another $50,000 pending for this work. They estimate the total cost to be $450,000. This project was developed by the Rondo Community Land Trust to ensure that small businesses can remain on Selby after redevelopment occurs. Over $13 million was secured to build two buildings at 852 Selby and 940 Selby. Both lots were vacant city-owned lots. The 852 Selby was vacant for 40 years. The 940 Selby was vacant for 25 years. On the first floor, there will be five businesses and two live workspaces in the development. As part of the project, Rondo has partnered with Community Housing Development Corporation to create 34 low-income senior rental housing on the second and third floor. The goal of the project is to keep the small business lease payment affordable for long term. Rondo CLT raised over $500,000 from local foundations to fill the gap between what the building costs to build and what the business can businesses can afford to pay in rent. The last part of this pioneering project is to complete the build out of the small business commercial spaces. The small businesses, including a new African-American-owned restaurant, cannot afford to cover the full cost of the build-outs. The restaurant, the coffee shop, and other businesses would make significant investment from other funding sources but cannot cover the entire cost. So with me today, I have Michael Wright, who is one of the persons who helped conceive this project and will be moving his Golden Time coffee shop into this project. Is here to give brief summary of the project and is why it's an important step in the revitalization of the Rondo neighborhood. So for any of you who come to the Rondo community, my community, and go on Selby Avenue and want to have a good coffee, good company, good space, Golden Time is the place to come. And if you haven't been there, you need to be there. It is the place to be. So with that, I turn it over to Michael Wright.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Michael Wright, and I am a Rondo CLT board member and co-owner with my wife, Stephanie, of Golden Time Coffee Cafe at the corner of Milton and Selby in St. Paul. Stephanie and I will be moving our coffee shop into this project. We are very excited to be part of this redeveloping Selby Avenue. The larger space will help us accommodate our growing business. The funds requested tonight from the state will not go to our new coffee shop. Together with the Rondo CLT, we have secured the funds to build out and finish the new coffee shop. The funding we are requesting tonight will help the other businesses that will be a part of this project. While I now have access to more private capital, 19 years ago when we opened Golden Time, we did not have access to private capital. It was tough in the early days, but we persevered. We have been very blessed. This project was conceived by neighborhood businesses and residents with a goal to find a way to keep small businesses, local minority businesses, on Selby and create more opportunities for small businesses on Selby as a whole. While we will never have the number of neighborhood businesses that we lost due to I-94 cutting through the community, displacing many of the family-owned businesses on Rondo, this project does seek to address the growing needs to help small business get established and grow on Selby. This project is proactive response to the growing gentrification of both housing and commercial development in the Rondo community. The funds requested tonight will help us complete the commercial build-out for the Selby Milton Victoria project and will help small businesses get established, grow, and create jobs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I have been to Golden Time, and
thank you.
I do like Golden Time, and I'm trying not to get killed with that sliding door on occasion.
Okay.
Are there any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the committee members? Any questions from the committee members? Seeing none. I'm excited to see this get done. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to get over there.
I am very, very excited. It is just a really great opportunity to keep local businesses in the community, hire local folks, young people, and others who live right there in the community to have jobs right there in the community. So it's a good initiative. It is great to see the vacant lots have been vacant for 40 years, 25 years, to have some of structure there on those corners. And from that, to see a community that is working its way back to thrive. It's a good deal.
All those in favor of We're just laying it over. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, House File 905. Representative Kegel. Representative Kegel, good to see you here. Kind of noticed that all these bills are members of the committee. So, smart CA. I see. Would you like to move your House File 905 for possible inclusion?
I would. I'd like to move House File 905 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I see you have an amendment.
I do, yes. It was the
A1?
I don't have it right on. Yeah, it does the appropriation for the bill.
All right.
Thank you. So it would...
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Explain your bill briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Getting to Work program, and so we all know a reliable vehicle is critical to the success of most working families. Car ownership enables people to have better access to jobs, work more hours, transport their children to childcare or school, and also take care of their family needs like groceries or medical appointments. I worked at an organization here in St. Paul, a community action organization that did administer these car loans to low-income families. And so I got to see the families that came in every day and benefited from this program. And so it's something that really helps people, get that car, helps them find reputable places to purchase the cars, and then helps build credit as well. And so just a little bit of background on the program. The legislature created the Getting to Work pilot program in 2017 to make low-interest car loans, affordable car repairs, or donated vehicles available to low-income families who need a car to get to work. Six nonprofit organizations received the Getting to Work grants to offer these services and are already helping people from the metro area, in the suburbs, and all the way up to the Arrowhead region with the transportation they need to get to work and take care of their families. So in House File 905, we know the need isn't going away. So House File 905 ensures that the Getting to Work grant program can continue to expand, can continue to help expand successful nonprofit vehicle programs so they can meet the needs in their communities, and also launch new programs in areas of the state where the service hasn't been available. So House File 905 codifies the language the legislature passed in 2017, making the Getting to Work program permanent, and appropriates $250,000 per year for grants to nonprofits for vehicle programs. And with that, I will turn over to my testifier.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the legislative advocate for the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. We're a coalition of nonprofit organizations across the state working directly with low-income families. We're very grateful to Representative Kegel for her leadership on this bill, and also for the co-authors on this committee, Chair Mahoney, Chair Carlson, Chair Moran, Representative Backer, and Representative Xiong. Thank you. Most of you probably know there are some fantastic nonprofit vehicle programs around the state helping people who need a car to get to work. These programs partner with auto dealerships, auto service providers, banks and credit unions, churches and civic organizations that want to invest in their community. As Representative Kegel mentioned, six of these programs were able to receive grants from the first round of funding in the Getting to Work program. DEED has published monitoring reports on each of these programs that have very detailed information about program models, partnerships in the community, how they met the matching fund requirements, spending, and community impact. I didn't have those included in your packet because it would have been a lot of paper, but I can forward those electronic files to anyone who's interested. I did ask that the overall DEED update report is in your packets for the aggregate grant program. That reports that of all of the folks who have received services from the Getting to Work programs, 26% report that the vehicle or repair enabled them to get a job. 77% reported it enabled them to keep a job. and 50% reported they were able to increase their income. I want to let you know that these programs aren't cookie-cutter programs. They've evolved to meet the need in their community. So, for instance, the Helping People Get There program at United Community Action takes referrals directly from their local workforce center of people currently receiving public assistance and who have a job offer but who need a car to take the job. Their grant enabled them to expand their service area from 4 to 9 counties in southwest Minnesota. The program at the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency takes referrals from human service agencies and clergy.
I'd like to interrupt here.
Sure.
Would it shorten your testimony if I told you that the chair liked your bill?
Yes. Would you like me to skip ahead? I just wanted to give some details of the programs. They're really fantastic, but I'm glad to hear that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And we actually have one of my former coworkers here who runs the program at Community Action and one of the participants of the program. They did travel here this evening. If they could just say a few brief words.
Surely.
Thank you.
Good evening. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Elba Castillo. Hello, community members. My name is Elba Castillo, as I mentioned. I am a financial service coordinator for Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties. Community Action is a local nonprofit agency working to reduce the causes of poverty and its impact on people's lives in our community. I manage the Car Ownership Loan Program, which was established by a grant from the McKnight Foundation more than 30 years ago. This is a revolving loan pool. This program provides a $6,000 loan to families who are below or at the 200% of the federal poverty guidelines and are in need of reliable transportation to maintain their jobs and improve their economic stability. While the Car Ownership Loan Program provides a greatly needed resource for our low-income families, prior to the Get Into Work funds, we had a major gap in our services. Many of those same families struggled to make need repairs to their vehicle, often choosing between meeting the basic needs and driving a car in bad shape, needing new tires or brakes. Because of the Get Into Work funds, we were able to help fill this gap by offering a $500 vehicle repair grant. So far, we have helped 33 families make needed repairs, ensuring safety and extending the life of the vehicle. We plan to help 12 other families and the remaining funds we have available. There are many stories that I can share to you with you today, but one in particular comes to my mind. This participant received a repair estimate of $800, much more than she could afford. The steering wheel began locking while she was driving, and the brake pads and the rotors needed to be replaced, both a huge safety risk. Being a household of five and the participant being the primary earner, and as a personal care attendant, the vehicle is necessary for her to keep her job. Because we do have partnership with local auto repairs, this participant received not only the $500 grant, but also a 15% discount given by one of our partners, Automax, in the local community. And she was able to repair her vehicle without falling behind on her rent and maintain her employment. So without these funds, her story would have been very different and likely resulted in a financial crisis for her and her family. And today we also have another participant of this grant that comes from the Get Into Work funds, Jacqueline Arias, who would like to share her story with you today. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jacqueline Arias. I wanted to share my story of how I got involved with Community Action's Car Loan and Repair Program. I've been working with Neighborhood Development Alliance, NEDA, for housing counseling for the past couple of years. When my vehicle was going out in the beginning of 2018, I talked with my NEDA counselor, and she gave me some information on Community Action's Car Loan Program. Since I was not in the position at the time to just go out and purchase a new vehicle, I had tried to get a loan at my bank because I had been building my credit up, but they said it was too soon and I would need to show at least a year of good credit. When my vehicle finally went out, I decided to call Community Action. I went through the steps of the program, including the financial literacy training, where I learned about things like budgeting, debt reduction, and building good credit. and a car care class to learn the basics of car maintenance. Then I finally purchased my vehicle for $5,800. It was such a blessing to me and my family since we were unable to get to work in school without a vehicle. I work in St. Paul and start at 6 a.m. On my lunch, I go home and take my grandson to school in West St. Paul and then drop my daughter off at work in Woodbury. I don't know if buses even run that early in the morning, so again, this program was such a blessing. 3 months after I purchased the vehicle, the wheel bearing went bad. I took the vehicle to the dealership, and they said it would be almost $500 to repair. They also advised that we stop driving the vehicle immediately because it was not safe to drive like that. I was worried about how we were going to fix it as we didn't have that much money on hand and couldn't afford to miss work. All of a sudden, I remembered that Community Action also had some funding available for the vehicle purchasers for repairs they might need on their vehicles once they made their third payment. I just so happened to have made my third payment and called Community Action right away. I brought the vehicle to one of the shops on the recommended list, and after they approved the repair, I was able to get my vehicle in right away. The next day, I picked up my vehicle and was back on the road again. I cannot thank Elba and Community Action enough for all their assistance that they provided. I'm very grateful for this program, and I hope that it continues to get the funding in order to help others that might be in the same position that I was in. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your story. And it's good to hear that you were able to take advantage of this and make your life better. That's kind of what we try to do up here, is help people make their lives better. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I will open the floor to questions from the members. Are there any questions from the members? Seeing none, would the author of the bill care to renew her motion?
I will renew my motion to lay over House File 905 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As amended?
As amended.
Thank you. Next is Representative Stevenson with House File 1507. That's what it means. This is a simple bill, correct?
Yes,
a simple bill.
I only carry simple bills.
That's what I thought.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1507 for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And, Mr. Chair, I have an author's amendment that I just follow your leadership in missing the 24-hour deadline. But this is the author's amendment is the A2 amendment, which I would actually like to move today. And it addresses some concerns that were raised by stakeholders involved in the Greater Minnesota Job Training Program and tries to reach a workable solution for everybody, and I think you'll hear in a few moments from testifiers that we were successful in that. So,
consensus is never fun.
The consensus is never fun, but it's a good outcome for everybody. I think that satisfies everybody with this amendment. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Would you like to move the A2 and get the bill in the shape that you would like?
I would move the A2.
All right. This is a pretty extensive bill amendment. So are there any questions from the members? Any questions from the members on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The bill is in the shape that you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll briefly explain the bill. The bill does two things. One is it makes a modification to the MIF program, which we've discussed extensively in this committee. It raises the cap on MIF grants from $1 million to $2 million, but puts some parameters on what would enable someone to access that higher funding amount. They'd have to leverage a certain amount of private sector investment and have a certain amount of jobs. So it allows us to tackle some bigger projects if we are getting a bigger return from the companies that are involved. The second thing that the bill does after the A2 amendment is replicate the very successful Greater Minnesota Job Training Program in the metro area. Initially, the underlying bill just expanded the program into the metro area, but people who work with that program felt like it was a good working program and didn't and I agree, it's a great working program. We had great testimony in the Labor Committee about how successful that program is. We just want to have a similar program in the metro area, so instead of expanding the Greater Minnesota program, what we're going to do now is create a mirror image program in the metro. It will be a little bit different in the metro in that we're going to have a cap on the size of the grants in the metro, which doesn't exist in the Greater Minnesota program, and we're going to focus in on manufacturing and technology jobs, which is where we think there's a real opportunity in the metro area and a real need for further job training in the metro area. So it will be a little bit different, but the broad construct of the program is just set to match the very successful Greater Minnesota program. So that is the gist of the bill. I think there's at least one or two testifiers who are going to speak to the bill, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Proceed.
Chair and committee members, my name is Lily Melander. I am the Government Relations Manager for Medical Alley Association. We are the cross-sector healthcare association that supports and advances the global leadership of Medical Alley's healthcare industry. I'm here to testify today in support of House File 1507. We appreciate Representative Stevenson for authoring the bill and for you for hearing it tonight. This piece of legislation is important for the growth of the health innovation and care industry in Minnesota. It enables companies seeking to grow the opportunity to partner with the public sector to train employees for newly created positions. By limiting the program in the metro area to only manufacturing and IT sectors, it focuses in not only where some of the greatest needs are, but some of the highest wages as well. There were over 117,000 postings for manufacturing and IT jobs in 2018. These two industries have average wages of $43,000 higher than the average wage of all other industries. The MIF program has also been key to growing the health innovation and care industry in Minnesota. Smiths Medical used MIF to build its new headquarters in Plymouth. Takeda leveraged it for its new Global Center of Excellence in Brooklyn Park. And in Rochester, Viriad received assistance in building a state-of-the-art manufacturing facility for anti-cancer vaccines. These are just some of the success stories of MIF-funded projects. By increasing the MIF ceiling, it will enable the state to keep and attract jobs in Minnesota. To conclude, to truly realize the vision of becoming the global epicenter of health innovation and care, Minnesota must grow our existing talent pool, prepare existing workforce, and provide an environment that attracts investment and increases the opportunity for health innovation and care organizations to succeed. This bill takes steps in addressing those challenges. Thank you.
Are there any other testifiers?
Yes, there's, I believe, one more.
Good evening. Please identify yourself for the tape. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty & Hood, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Stevenson for working with us over the past couple of days to address some concerns that we had with the original iteration of the bill. He really did yeoman's work to work with us in a compressed time frame to address our concerns. And I do think, Mr. Chair, as Representative Stevenson said, that we've come to a resolution that is going to serve the job training needs of both the metro area and Greater Minnesota, and that the program that is created in the new version of House File 1507 will complement the existing Greater Minnesota focused job training innovation program. With that, Mr. Chair, again, I want to thank Representative Stevenson and the committee.
Thank you. That's the end of the testifiers, as I see. Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against this this bill? Seeing none, I will open it up to questions from members. Are there any questions from the members? Not seeing any? Oh, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I missed this, because I'm going between two committees tonight, you just tell me I missed it.
Okay.
But can you clarify the March 31st date for Greater Minnesota projects and why that is in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haley, so the amendment removes the March 31st date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the bill author? Seeing none. All those in favor of laying it over, signify by saying no. Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Am I staying here? Yeah.
Representative Knorr. Oh, back to back. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is it 1424?
Mr. Chair, I thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would move that House 1424 be referred to Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means?
To Ways and Means.
All right.
And
proceed.
Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment. I would move the A5 amendment. This amendment gets the bill in the shape that I would like the committee to consider it in.
Okay. All those in favor of the, well, could you explain what it does? Or do you want to wait and do it with
I'm happy to explain it now, Mr. Chair. The amendment does a number of different things. One, we are in an ongoing process of working with the Department of Commerce to address some issues with how state and federal law interplay on this issue, and it makes some changes around the licensing issues to try and address some of those concerns. Secondly, it adds some language related to duties that student loan servicing companies would have under this bill that are designed to complement some of the restrictions that are in the bill. And third, it funds, it has an appropriation to the Department of Commerce to fund the advocate position that's created by the bill.
Oh. Well, okay. Still looking at the appropriation.
Yeah. The appropriation, Mr. Chair, matches the fiscal note.
You know, when you're in the majority, you hate fiscal notes.
No comment.
Yeah, no comment. All those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You have the bill in the shape that you would like it. You have some a testifier, or are you going to take this one on your own?
I would like to start by explaining the bill, and then I do have one testifier.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the United States is in the middle, and Minnesota is in the middle of a student loan crisis. The United States has $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt, making student loan debt the second largest debt that United States citizens carry in this country, behind only mortgage debt. It's now ahead of credit card debt. Here in Minnesota, we have 775,000 student loan borrowers and $27.1 billion in student loan debt. That is, there's a 127% increase in student loan debt just between the years of 2007 and 2017. And importantly, this is an issue that faces all of Minnesota. 51.4% of millennials in greater Minnesota carry student loan debt. And today I happened to get this great report that was put out this year by the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank. And what it notes is something that is just really troubling to me, that it indicates that in greater Minnesota, student loan debt is a high contributor to the population drain that we're seeing in small towns and communities in greater Minnesota. It notes that 37% of individuals who live in greater Minnesota and have the just 37% of rural individuals in the highest quartile of student loan balances remain in rural areas 1 year after entering repayment, compared to 73% of those in the lowest quartile of student loan balances, which suggests that people who have high student loan debts are leaving greater Minnesota in order to seek higher paying jobs so they can afford their student loan balances. So this is an issue that is profoundly affecting our state in many different ways, and this bill seeks to get at that problem by giving student loan borrowers someone in their corner, someone to fight for them against the abuses, misleading, and confusion that occurs in the student loan industry. It sets some rules of the road that should prevent some of the abuses, that the worst abuses and worst behavior on the part of student loan servicing companies. And I'll give you just one really brief example. There's a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness that exists in the federal government. What that program does is that if someone works in a public service capacity, either for a state or local government, or they work for a non-for-profit for 10 years and makes payments on their loans for those 10 years, they can have their student loan balances forgiven by the federal government. That program came into existence in 2007, which means that the first people who were eligible to see their loans forgiven applied for forgiveness in 2017. In 2018, the Department of Education released a report showing that out of the first 29,000 people who applied for forgiveness under this program, 98% were rejected. Of those, 28% of the rejections had to do with filing errors, clerical mistakes. And 70% of the total had to do with not meeting program requirements, meaning that people were not in the right repayment program, they didn't have quite the right job. So these are people who made considerable financial sacrifices in working in public sector employment or in not-for-profit employment, expecting to see their student loans forgiven, and at the end of that 10-year period, have nothing to show for it under that program. And in a lot of cases, if they had had the correct information up front about the choices that they were making, they may have made a very different choice. And so we're trying to give students someone in their corner to give them the information they need to make responsible choices up front so they don't find themselves in trouble down the road, and to protect them against the worst abuses of the student loan industry. And Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I do have one testifier.
Why don't we bring up your testifier? Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ciccone, and I'm one of two staff members at Education Minnesota who help educators with loan forgiveness. Though at this point, we kind of take all comers. Anybody who calls, we provide whatever help we can. That includes school administrators, police officers. We've talked to military families trying to get out of default. We're hoping to help anybody we can. So I'm here tonight to express our support for this bill, and I want to share just a few stories briefly that illustrate why this is very necessary legislation. As you heard, Minnesota ranks fifth in the nation for student debt, and more than 775,000 Minnesotans have student debt. It averages about $35,000 per borrower. A statistic that scares me is that the group that sees the largest increase in student debt right now, over the last 5 years, it's about 46% are seniors over the age of 60, and those folks are taking on student loans for their kids and their grandkids. A statistic that scares me more is the disparate impact for our communities of color. Across Minnesota, about 8% of student loan holders who live in primarily white communities have student loan debt in collection, but when you look at our communities of color, it's about 24%, nearly one in four people with student loan debt have that debt in collection. We know that other states have or are in the process of creating student loan advocate offices to level the playing field for borrowers. So what I wanted to share was what we hear from people who would otherwise be calling this office. So one is that we need better information about loans and loan repayment options. We're not getting it from loan servicers. We're not getting it from college financial aid offices. For example, a 10th grade special ed teacher I talked to last week was told 10 years ago that her first monthly payment had to be $900 a month. That was it. That had to be her payment. So as a result, she just got her loans out of default 10 years later because no one told her about income-driven repayment plans. A second thing we hear over and over is that we need someone to set standards for loan servicers and try to hold them accountable, including very basic things like maintaining accurate records. So a member from Coon Rapids spent 6 months reapplying for a repayment plan on her loans because her servicer sent it back to be corrected 6 different times. And at that point, her loans accrued a ton of interest at a huge cost to her, but at no cost to them. I think what we see is that taking out student loans is an unavoidable reality for individuals and families who are paying for college right now, and we think that House File 1424 puts some protections for those borrowers in place and follows the lead of other states who see this as necessary for families, for communities, and our state's collective financial future. Thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you. Hopefully you'll stick around if there's questions. Do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions from the members? Any questions from the members? I'll ask one, hopefully very quickly. Do you think the loan collectors are smart enough to figure out that if they keep throwing people back into the water, they might collect a lot more interest off of those poor students that have gone into deep debt to take over from us old people?
Mr. Chair, I think that the student loan service companies are pretty smart.
That sounds like a pretty good political answer. Any questions? Seeing none. All those in favor of moving House File 1424 to Ways and Means as amended, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to Ways and Means. Representative Knorr, I think you have a bill. Two of them. Whoa. I saw that. Yeah.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I bring my testifier.
Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. It's been a long day. I would like to move House File 2120 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, this is a bill similar to one of the bills that was actually vetoed by the governor in the last session. This bill addresses a significant need in employment in the city of Westside. So this bill addresses the biggest challenge that we have in terms of an area that whereby the average income or the median income is $15,000. At the same time, we have seen the significant challenges that are being faced by many individuals that I'm going to cover shortly. The partnership that I'm addressing here, it will be led by Hennepin County. The partnership includes the University of Minnesota, Augsburg University, the Fairview, includes ABC, which you will be hearing about it. So that partnership working with the City Riverside Neighborhood Organization will be providing services of employment to individuals who have been challenged. This provides an opportunity for adults and youth to get employment and to gain self-sufficiency. This will address the issue of unemployed and underemployed. The unemployment rate in that neighborhood is almost 14%. The low literacy and also English language that is becoming a problem for many employers, this will provide an opportunity for employers to connect with employees, the job seekers who have got mental illness or other disabilities, displaced workers, students who are out of school, and many other challenges. Mr. Chair and members, as someone who has worked in that area, even working with employer, some of the challenges that the young people face is, number one, they may have a record, a criminal record that will prevent them from getting employment. The second other challenge that I've seen is for those young people who may test for drugs and being excluded from employment. That requires a significant investment from the county and also requires for us to provide those opportunities for those individuals who have got disabilities and because of their second language as English and significant challenges, which I have a testifier who will talk about it. So this is a great opportunity to provide employment to those who have got barriers and significant challenges. Mr. Chair, this bill will provide an employment to almost 1,000 individuals in that small area or that neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, my name is Muzamil Ibrahim, and thank you very much for this chance. And I am from Cedar Riverside neighborhood, and I've lived in that neighborhood for about 10 years. And in these 10 years, as a person with disability and as a person who found his new home, I did not have any path, or many other people with disabilities, young people, did not have any other choice to join and bond with their new community. And what we are asking today is to include us in any programs or in any opportunities, job access to jobs that comes into that neighborhood. And for me, as an immigrant, as black person, and as person with disability, and when I do apply to jobs, before I get to this, I'm actually graduating from University of Minnesota this May and getting my degree in youth studies. And at this point, you know, there should be a chance for me to get into a job But when I do apply to a job and, you know, there is a box that I need to check, that is whether I have disability or not. And when I check that, and the result is often that I'm not accepted to jobs. And so this is the experience that I am having and the experience of many young immigrants, people in that neighborhood are having. And so we are excluded in any ways, and we are not having a chance to connect it to a job and to realize our dreams and to bond with our new community. And we are asking to have that access to make that ways or make the path better for us to realize our dream and connect to jobs and education.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there isn't any other testifier, but if anybody has got any question, I'll be more than happy to answer that.
Well, let's see if there's anyone else in the audience that cares to speak to this particular bill. Anyone else, pro or con? Seeing none, I will open up this. I will open up the questions from the members. Are there any questions from the members? Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion for to lay House File 2120 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion for House File 2120 to be to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. You are laid over. Representative Norrie, you have House File 2287.
One second.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2287 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to give you a little bit of a briefing, I came here with someone who didn't have enough knowledge in most of the things. I didn't know how to use a computer. It took me a determination to get the skills to learn how to use a computer. With that determination, I enrolled in myself into a college. And my dream was to become an IT. It took me a while, but I did graduate with a computer science degree from Metro State. That journey helped me to become the system management position in the state of Minnesota, given with the opportunity to really work on the issues that we deal with every day, every single day here. Managing the Department of Human Services programs. Mr. Chair, that was once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Technology is changing every 18 months. With this bill, it creates an opportunity to create apprenticeship. This will be the first time that we do have an apprenticeship in IT in the state of Minnesota. We cannot miss this opportunity. This bill establishes apprenticeship that will work with DEED, but I do believe apprenticeship programs come from the Department of Labor. As you can see in your packet, there's an apprentice program that was created to provide apprenticeship program in the state of Washington. This program has expanded to 12 states as of today. They're providing a solid background information apprenticeship by creating opportunities for many. As you can see, we already have a technological challenge. I wanted to walk you through that process by using the PowerPoint presentation and with some embedded guide. So this bill will establish that apprenticeship program, which will be developed working with a program like Apprenti to establish a way for young people, especially those who are moving from one job to the other, anyone who is of a veteran, someone of color who wants to move into the IT field, so that they can really move through the economic mobility and get income that can sustain them for a long time. We do have a significant challenge whereby if we don't attract people to come and work in the state of Minnesota in the IT field, we will be left behind. In the packet, you can also see the support from the two big organizations that have indicated they do support this bill to create an apprenticeship program. from the Minnesota High Tech Association and Medical Alley Association. This speaks for itself, Mr. Chair. And if there's someone from Dali who had the experience to sit down with the apprentice group, which I didn't have that knowledge, that I was informed that they presented this approach to the State Department of Labor. If they can testify and provide us more input into that, I'll appreciate that.
Do you have any testifiers, sir?
Mr. Chair, my testifier could not make it today. So I wanted to ask for your leeway and be able to work with the Department of Labor so that we can really hone down in terms of creating apprenticeship in IT, which I think will also help the pipe fitters to understand how to use the technology that we're going to be creating in the state.
We already got that down. We've been fixing buildings from the truck because you have to use a computer and wireless stuff. It's amazing to look into the service vans. I have a question here, and then I'll open it to other members. I'm looking at your apprenticeship process here, and I have some questions, and I have some concerns about calling it an apprenticeship. Typically, in an apprenticeship, a federally recognized apprenticeship, there's 144 hours of classroom per year. And correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Sundin, is it 1,800 hours or 10,000? How many hours in a year do you have to work?
2,000 per year.
So I don't see that in the bill. So I'll talk with you offline on it. But you have to meet standards to be called an apprenticeship. And I think everyone at the legislature has decided to call something an apprenticeship when it really isn't. So,
Mr. Chair, Apprenti is the only registered IT apprenticeship with the Department of Labor at the national level. So this is already
But this started. Is Minnesota. We have special rules. We actually have one of the most robust apprenticeship programs in the nation, and I'm pretty protective of what you call an apprenticeship program. We'll take this offline and check to make sure that you're going to check all the boxes on this apprenticeship program.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions? Representative Sundin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to choose not to prolong this.
Thank you.
Representative Nora, would you like to renew your motion to lay over House File 2287 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nora. Or Representative Nora.
Thank you.
Maybe.
Mr. Sundin, you have a bill up.
Representative Sundin, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion. Where's this headed?
Referred to Ways and Means.
Okay, I'd like to move House File 879 for consideration at Ways and Means Committee. I'd like to read all the changes in the bill and then turn it over to a testifier. If you look on 1.8, it says defend.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, good evening. My name is Jason Tarasek. I'm a construction lawyer. I have my own firm in Edina. I'm also a member of the board of directors of the Minnesota Subcontractors Association. Thank you for hearing this bill tonight. This is a bill about basic fairness and common sense. In 2013, the legislature decided that the public policy should be that everyone should pay for their own negligence on construction projects. Shortly after that law was passed, however, attorneys found a loophole. They now argue that you You can't be made to pay for the damages someone causes, but you can be made to pay someone's legal fees for damages that they cause. Today, we're here to fix that problem. House File 879 closes that loophole. If this bill is passed, the negligent party will have to pay their own legal fees. The current practice is unfair to small businesses that have to agree to terms to get the work. They're taking on risks that they have no control over, and they may have to pay the lawyer's fees for someone else's negligent acts. If you pass House File 879, this unfair practice will be stopped. The bill does two things to end this practice. It adds the word defend to the definition of indemnity agreement, and it deletes the ambiguous words or project-specific insurance, including without limitation. So number one, by adding the word defend to the definition of an indemnity agreement, you close a loophole. The party that is responsible for the damage will also be responsible for their own legal fees. The passage of this bill will not affect the practice that obligates a subcontractor to pay for the general contractor's attorney's fees if the subcontractor is negligent. But if the subcontractor is negligent, the sub would pay the general contractor's legal fees. This is because the right to require insurance for vicarious liability is explicitly protected in Minnesota Statute Section 337.05, Subdivision 1D. This bill doesn't change that. Second, by deleting the words, quote, or project-specific insurance, including without limitation, end quote, you close another loophole that some parties are using to pass on costs for legal fees and actual damages onto subcontractors, even when the subcontractor is not negligent. To use this loophole, a party requires the subcontractor to get project-specific commercial general liability insurance at additional cost to a subcontractor, and then argues that if the subs get this insurance, that the entire indemnity statute doesn't apply. This bill is about basic fairness. Subcontractors are not trying to get out of being responsible for their own actions or their own legal fees. They just don't want to pay the legal fees for another negligent party. 19 associations, including my association, the Minnesota Subcontractors Association, support this bill. Please pass House File 879. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name again, please, for the record.
Oh, my name is Jason Tarasek.
Thank you so much, Mr. Jason. So we do have another person who wanted to testify. Mary?
I'm Chair.
Representative,
I did have a question for the testifier. Can I ask him, or should I wait to the next testifier?
Please go ahead and ask.
Okay, thank you, Chair. You know, from your perspective and so forth, and I'm sorry, share me your name again.
It's Jason Tarasek.
Thank you. Do you see this increasing in litigation with this change, or would we be able to decrease some litigation with this change in the law?
I think,
Mr. Tarasek.
Yeah, Representative, Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I think
thank you.
Part of the problem... Part of the problem with giving a specific answer is that a lot of lawsuits are settled and subject to confidentiality agreements after they're settled. So I could speak anecdotally that I know there are cases going on right now where subcontractors are being asked to pay a general contractor's attorney's fees, even when a subcontractor is arguably completely not at fault. In some cases, even when a general contractor, I know of one particular case where a general contractor dropped something on someone's head and then asked the subcontractor to defend them against the ensuing lawsuit. That's the sort of mischief we're asking you to help us avoid.
Thank you.
That's it. No follow-up.
So the next testifier, Ms. Mary Guerra. Welcome. Please state your name and proceed.
So my name is Mary Waro, and I am very pleased to be here this evening. I'm the general counsel at Ryan Companies. We're a Minnesota-based company founded in Hibbing in 1938. As part of my responsibilities at Ryan, I am responsible for all of our insurance procurement. And so I also deal with a number of claims. And so I see how the practical application of this statute plays out in practice. I am not in favor of House File 879, which would repeal the duty to defend. I believe that the bill would have unintended consequences for owners, general contractors, and cause longer, more expensive litigation, and increase the cost of construction projects. The current system that we have is efficient and allocates the risk among the parties who are closest to that risk. And in point, I haven't seen any insurance companies here saying that the duty to defend is somehow unfair. The duty to defend additional insureds is an absolutely fundamental part of insurance of all CG, commercial general liability policies, as well as environmental liability policies, not just for the construction industry, but across all industries. The duty to defend obligation does not allow for contractors to defend another contractor or a general to defend an owner for all claims arising out of the project. Instead, it is triggered by claims that are specifically related to the work of the subcontractor with the duty to defend. In other words, there has to have been some negligence on the part of the contractor to trigger that duty to defend. In fact, my own personal experience in dealing with claims is that insurers will reject a duty to defend unless there is some nexus to that contractor who was negligent. So if this bill is passed, I believe that the cost of insurance for construction projects is going to increase because owners would not have any coverage for that duty to defend. Generals would not have that coverage for matters caused by their subcontractors, and that would cause all construction projects to be done under something called a wrap-up program, which is called an OSIP, an owner-controlled insurance program, or a contractor-controlled insurance program. Those programs are more expensive and will add to the cost of your construction project. I believe that the current system is equitable and fair, is efficient, and should not be changed.
Thank you so much. I do have Mr. Mike Schechter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Schechter again with Associated General Contractors. Very pleased that Mary Warro was here. She's an expert in this area, and her testimony, I mean, this is exactly how it works. Simply put, it doesn't happen this way. Subcontractors are not being held responsible for things where they're not negligent. The way it happens is someone gets injured, a plaintiff's attorney sues and brings everybody in. And, of course, they bring in the general because the general is perceived as having more money or having more ability to pay. They could also bring the owner in. Why? Because the owner probably has more money, too. And then everybody sorts out who actually caused it. So, yes, if someone dropped a hammer and someone else got injured and the sub is saying, well, gee, it wasn't me, that's why it happens, because the plaintiff's attorney brings everybody in. Very clearly, as Mary just said, the insurance company for the sub will say, no, it's not us, and will reject coverage. The vicarious liability, which was mentioned, is something different. And I want to address this specifically. Vicarious liability is when a plaintiff's attorney tries to hold a general responsible for really something that the sub did. So, for instance, if the sub screws up, makes a mistake, causes a harm, plaintiff's attorney sues the sub, and then will sue the general for something like not supervising the sub adequately. So, yes, if the general wasn't supervising the sub adequately, that is entirely the general's negligence, but it's really caused by what the sub did in the first place. There's been a problem that what happens is the general gets insurance, the sub gets insurance, and these two insurance companies are fighting and causing a litigation over what is the percentage of liability. The workaround is what we call vicarious liability,
We ask the sub to buy insurance that includes what they do and the vicarious claims. In other words, when someone brings this claim for negligent supervision for what the sub did in the first place, one insurance carrier will cover both claims, and the sub procures the insurance. And the percentage that covers the general pays. We have spelled this out. The AGC recently came out with a new subcontract agreement. It is out there. People are using it. I brought a copy of the page that clearly spells this out. In other words, we are not asking the sub to pay for insurance for the general. All we're asking is to make the system more efficient so that we don't have the insurance companies fighting, and we're trying to cut the plaintiff's bar from trying to do something tricky. But again, if you want a copy of this, I brought about 15. It shows as clearly as you possibly can the exposure of the subs is limited to the negligence the subs caused and no more.
Please give to the page so that we can get the copies. Mr. Chair, did you have a question for the testifier? Chair Mahoney.
This would be for Ms.
Whoa.
Don't do that. I was going to, I almost had this one. You should have been here last night when I couldn't even pronounce my own name.
I'll give you a tip. Just think Warroad, Minnesota, but drop the D at the end.
That's where I was going. That was kind of where I was going. Can you tell me when did the idea of confidentiality in the settlement come about? Because if one of your contractors was working on my house or working on somebody's house and I wanted to hire them for my job, but they have 7 lawsuits against them, I can't find out. And I don't want a plumber that gets sued 7 times working on my house because I know what sewer gas smells like. So when did that come into play? When did they start saying, well, you can't? We're going to seal this lawsuit, and we're not going to tell anybody about it?
Ms. Warrow.
I haven't had that same experience as you. When we respond to requests for proposal or when we are also qualifying subcontractors on jobs, we do ask for litigation histories from them, so that we know whether or not they've had claims. Sometimes we have also asked for loss runs from insurance companies.
Chair Mahoney?
No, that's fine.
Do we have any questions from the members? Ms. Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have no background in the construction industry, so I've just been trying to read up on this and talk to my constituents. I've heard from constituents on both sides, honestly, so I'm torn. And I just appreciate your testimony, but I wondered if I could hear your response to her testimony.
Well, thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair, committee members. It doesn't mesh with what I have seen in the world. I don't want to get into an argument up here, but in my experience, the problem that we are trying to correct through this bill is that subcontractors are being forced to pay the legal fees of general contractors without regard to whether they are at fault. That was the problem this legislature tried to solve in 2013. We were trying to eliminate broad form indemnification. Creative attorneys found an end around with that in terms of trying to impose costs on subcontractors without regard to their fault by making them defend those lawsuits. That's the loophole we're trying to close with this bill.
Representative Robbins?
Thank you. Sorry. Could she respond one more time? I'll stop. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Ms. Roro.
The additional insured endorsements that are in use today, and I don't want to get technical, but they date back to 2007, and then it's the 04-13, so they were just updated in 2013. Those endorsements, and that's what triggers the duty to defend under that insurance policy, requires that insured have a degree of fault. So in other words,
they don't allow for that situation where I, as a general, would be 100% at fault. I would not be able to have any duty to defend by a subcontractor. You know, this isn't just a subcontractor issue either. You know, I, as a general contractor, in all of the contracts that we enter into with owners, we're required to indemnify and defend them as well for things that would arise out of our negligence. So some of you might think, hey, this would be a good thing for generals if it's the subs. They should be aligned. But I'm taking the position, because we also own property, we're a general contractor, on balance, I think the current system is fair, because that duty to defend is being tied to a negligent act by that insuring party with the with that insured party with the duty to defend. I think it's fair. I have a case currently where an owner has requested that we defend them, and our insurance company has denied it for exactly that reason. They have failed to demonstrate any negligence on our part. And unless and until they're able to do that, the insurance company isn't going to change its mind. So I do think that the current system is fair. That's been my experience. I've been doing this at Ryan for over 16 years and practicing law longer than that, but specifically being in a general contractor for over 16 years.
Representative Beck.
Thank you, Chair. So, and if this doesn't make sense totally, but here's what I understand, and from listening to both of you, is that basically, in some practical experience, if there's a problem on the site currently, so more people, how you bring everybody to the table is basically you say, hey, we're going to sue you all. You bring, and this is how I'm understanding it, then they all come to the table. What the other party's saying is, if there's not concrete evidence, those subcontractors will not be sued to bring into the table. That is, listening to the two of you, that's kind of how I'm understanding it. If I'm not correct, then correct me. But because you said that, oh, we were only going after someone that has a problem. Well, I've been only in a few situations, and basically, if you can breathe and fog up a mirror and you're close to the situation, you're going to get sued, okay? Because they want to try to collect as much money as possible. So what I understand that this bill will do is really narrow that road down. So am I correct or am I incorrect? That's my question.
Well, I'd be happy to take that. So, you know, when an accident happens on a job site, there are multiple parties who may be sued. An owner may be one of the primary targets because, quite honestly, their name is easy to look up in the real estate records and the tax records for the municipality. A general contractor is very easy to sue as well because they're going to have signage. And though a party who tripped and fell or had some sort of accident, they may not know the subcontractor who was involved in that. They will always look to that owner and to that general contractor because they see that that's easy. And then they may just bring in subcontractors as well. But that duty to defend is not going to be accepted unless they can actually show that there has been some negligence. So in other words, the negligent work of a particular party. If it's a general contractor, then yes, I would have that duty to defend. Our insurance company would pick that up if it was related to our work that was negligent. If it's related to a subcontractor's work and I get brought into that, then I do look to that subcontractor's insurer to defend us, but they won't do that unless it's being tied to their actual negligent work.
Can I pick up on that, please?
Very quickly, yes. What you identified is a bigger problem. I mean, what you're now talking about is tort reform. because this isn't just construction. This is, you bring your car into the car shop and there's something wrong, so what does a plaintiff's attorney do? Sues the car repair shop and sues Ford Motor Company, probably the tire manufacturer, and everybody, because who knows, was it the faulty tire, was it the bearings, was it the repair shop, or was it Ford? And whoever's the richest person, at the end of the day, you figure out what caused it and who's the richest person there. And there's a lot of reasons for that, because we have statute of limitations, we have notice, we have other laws that apply. So plaintiff's lawyer 101, what do you do when you have an accident? You bring everybody in into the burrito and then you sort it out. So, yes, that's a problem. Someone gets injured, they figure out who's in the burrito, they put them all in, you sort it out. But this isn't a construction problem, this is a tort problem.
Thank you so much, Representative Sandin. I'd like to renew your motion. Representative Sandin renews his motion to refer the House File 879 to the Committee of Ways and Means.
Can I have a last word on that, please?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Committee, for listening to a lot of legal theory that I really didn't expect. And we heard some very good hypothetical situations presented by a couple of people and a real-life situation by another. And I'd just like to point out, I'd like to boil it down, simplify it. If you broke it, you bought it. Now, if I broke it, I should be held responsible. If that guy broke it, he should be held responsible. He shouldn't be able to, I shouldn't be able to be held responsible for his mistakes or his for mine. So thank you very much. I'd like to renew the motion for 879 to be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you. House file. Yeah. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? See none. House file 879 is being referred to Ways and Means. Mr. Chair.
Which one are we doing? Good evening.
Good evening.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to move House File 2138 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I don't think I have an amendment, but maybe. No, I don't. What House File 2138 does is it's a minority business development competitive grant program. It asks for $15 million in initial funding, $3 million for back office services for statewide business development and assistance services to minority-owned businesses, which would then make this eligible. I think it's six, and I'll read them here. What this grant program would do was split this $15 and $3 million amongst these organizations: African Development Center, African Economic Development Solutions, Asian Economic Development Association, Latino Economic Development Center, Metropolitan Economic Development Agency, and Northside Economic Opportunity Network. There's some requirements for reporting to the minority and majority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over economic development. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask my testifier, Gary Cunningham, to say a few words.
Mr. Cunningham, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Yes, my name is Gary Cunningham. I'm the CEO and president of MEDA, Metropolitan Economic Development Association. And I'm here representing Catalyst. It's a group of seven Minnesota-based minority business support organizations, some of whom are here, the executive directors or CEOs. Could you please stand up and be acknowledged? And they represent African Development Center, African Economic Development, Asian Economic Development Center, Community Reinvestment Fund, Latino Economic Development Center, MEDA, and NEON in North Minneapolis. I'm going to go quickly because I know you've been here a long time, so I will bear with me for just a moment. The reason that we're asking for this is that we believe that developing minority entrepreneurs is the secret sauce for prosperity in Minnesota. We think that throughout, whether you're in Hibbing or whether you're in Rochester, whether you're on the western part of the state in Morris, there are minority entrepreneurs are growing at a substantial rate. We provide, as a group, we're called Catalysts, and we provide access to capital, business expertise, and access to contracts, both public and private. We do that by providing money, meaning lending capital. We provide access to markets, and we also provide management education to minority entrepreneurs. This year, we asked Russell Herter, which is a marketing firm, to actually look at minority entrepreneurship throughout the state of Minnesota. And they've done a pretty deep analysis, and one thing came very clear. Almost half of those minority entrepreneurs actually need capital to grow. We did find some differences between Greater Minnesota and the metro area, and all of us work throughout the state with minority entrepreneurs to help them grow. So whether you're in the Main Street or whether you're in the back office, we are working with those entrepreneurs to make them successful. In 2012, the U.S. Census does a business census every 12 years, and the last one was from 2007 to 2012. And in that system, data, they determined that there were 47,500 minority entrepreneurs that existed in Minnesota in 2012. And they grew by about 53% from 2007 to 2012. They're the fastest growing group that we have of businesses in Minnesota. They represent, as of 2012, 70,000 employees. And they have about $1.7 billion they add that to the state economy. We asked Clifton Larson Allen to do an analysis for us to determine what is the economic impact going forward and how can we think about what growing minority entrepreneurs would be for the state of Minnesota. And their analysis shows that the current rate of growth that over a three-year period, an increase in annual minority business sales by just 5% would add $900 million to the state's economy, create 10,000 new jobs, and increase incomes for Minnesota families by $223 million. This is not a social service approach. This is actually using market-based strategies to change the economic conditions and to bring capital into communities that haven't seen it. The bill that's before you, House File 2138, the Catalyst proposal we call it, would create a $12 million pool of financings for minority entrepreneurs throughout the state. It would leverage funds to create lending capital for these businesses, and we believe that we can match this both with private sector dollars and foundation dollars, that we could increase that to $150 million over a 10-year period. And these funds actually revolve, so they don't just go in somewhere, they come out. Our average loan loss at MITA, for example, is 1.1%. So we know how to lend to businesses that have been turned down by the traditional banking system and actually be repaid. The technical assistance dollars, and these are critical because that's what really makes the reason why we are able to lend successfully to these businesses, is that we're providing deep management education, coaching, and business supports. And this includes creating new jobs, supporting business starts, mergers and acquisition support, training. So what we're doing with this Catalyst is we're creating products and services for each stage of the business life cycle for minority businesses. And so here's what we are able to say with this investment. And this is conservative in terms of our projections. But we expect within the 2 years of the biennium, if we're awarded these dollars, that we will be able to provide 500 minority businesses with services. We will create or retain an additional 2,500 quality jobs, and MITA's average jobs, for example, is $22 an hour for our clients. Increase client profitability or profits by an average of 15% by the technical assistance interventions, and provide training and workshops to over 2,000 minority entrepreneurs in every part of the state. The long-term impact, lending capital will continue to be employed. As I said, this actually is a revolving loan fund, and that this will create an additional 2,500 jobs over 10 years. We can put our data up, both the data that we've worked with the Department of Economic Development that we've had, and we can actually show you that we can actually achieve these goals based on our historic performance with previous competitive grants that we've had. The total impact of what we're talking about is 5,000 quality jobs in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I stand ready to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Beck.
Thank you, Chair. Question, and it's a good idea. My question comes down to, you know, what criteria are going to be used to determine who to work with? Because obviously you want to work with the more hungry entrepreneurs, you know. When you're hungry, you do things. I'm a small business owner. There's things that you do because at the end of the day, you sign the check. But what criteria are you guys going to use to determine, and I'm not looking for a two-hour list, but, you know, what some of the main points that you're going to use to determine who gets what? Like you mentioned, when I was walking in Morris, Minnesota, I represent Morris, mm-hmm. and so forth. But in all parts of the state, what criteria would you use, please?
Mr. Cunningham.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that we're doing, first of all, we're already doing this work, so this is not new work that we would do. And we actually assess each entrepreneur by walking them through a process of whether they're red, yellow, or green. Some people come in and they're ready to go and they're hungry and they're ready, they get assessed as green. Other people come in and they don't have it all together. We actually work with them to see what else they need to do. And in order to be qualified for a loan, for example, you can't just walk in the door and be qualified. There's things you have to do. Get your credit records in order. We find that people that actually are hungry actually know what they need to do already, as you say. And then there's folks that want to be entrepreneurs, that think they actually can do it, but actually are not prepared or ready yet to be that entrepreneur. And so we've been working, so MITA, for example, has been in business for 47 years. We've grown some of the largest minority businesses in the state. So if you look at Twin Cities Business list of 100 top grossing minority business that comes out every year, we've worked with 90% of those businesses. So our consultants actually really know what they're doing when they make that assessment of that business. Things that we look at, as I said, credit record, have you paid your phone bill? Are you paying your bills? And if you are, if you're not, then we actually have programs that actually can get you ready to do that for a loan. On the technical side, it gets more complicated because you're looking at issues of what do they know in their industry, what kind of networks are they involved with, what is their plan, what is their business plan for growing their businesses. So those are some of the things that we look at. Each of us are a little different. MITA serves those businesses that are in growth industries. Others serve neighborhood businesses that are on storefronts. And so those are different criteria that one would use depending on the type of business that you're looking at.
Just comment. I appreciate that. Basically, what you're saying is if they're not doing the basics with excellence, paying their basic home bills and stuff, they're not going to be a green.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. But we also provide ways for them to, you know, sometimes people have good ideas and they just need some help trying to figure out how to do those things. And so we help them do that as well. But we also have to be very, we're stewards of these dollars, and so we have to be very careful how we're placing these dollars to make sure that if we invest in a company, that it has great potential for growth. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've been able to do. Our loan loss, as I said, I might have said, for MEDA, for example, is 1.1%. If any bankers in the room, they'll know that that is an excellent track record over the last 3 years.
Thank you. I know it's late. I'll keep it short. I just wondered if you could give us an example of the average size of your loans, the length of the loans, the interest rate, just how the loan program works more specifically.
Yeah, and I can speak to MEDA more specifically. Mr. Chairman, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can speak to MEDA specifically. Each of us have a little different portfolio and loan terms. So they may be somewhat different. So our average loan at MEDA is about $100,000. Normal length of the loan is a couple of years. Like 2 years. We provide in our portfolio now about 156 loans right now in our portfolio. For example, I'm trying to remember the rest of your question. Excuse me?
Interest rate.
Our interest rate ranges depending on the product. We have different products like a line of credit product, but it's 7 or 8% usually, depending, again, on the product and the collateral that's offered, et cetera. So the terms may be different depending on the conditions, credit record, what's the risk rating for that individual.
Are there any questions from members? Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question. I just want to make a comment. We know how important it is for people to have some sort of a wealth and to create wealth in communities of color. A lot of times these are individuals that don't have credit score that they can go to Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank to just get a loan approved. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. I know many of the organizations that are listed in this bill, and this is a good bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
With that, Mr. Chair, did you want to have your closing remarks and renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a good bill. Four out of the six of these organizations have worked either in my district or close to my district. I fully support this bill, and I'm hoping to find more money for these particular people as we move forward. They do work with some of the smallest of the small businesses, and they have resources that help those small businesses survive, which is really one of the hardest things for small businesses to do.
Thank you. Mr. Chair renews his motion for House File 2138 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
We have the last bill, which is 2043, House File 2043.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2043 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And I hear, I see you have got a DE amendment. Would you like to move the DE amendment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the DE1 amendment. And get it in the bill in the fashion that I would like it. Would you like me to explain it, or do you want to put the bill on, the amendment on first?
We'll take the amendment first. We have an amendment, DE1. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. The amendment has been adopted.
Mr. Chair, thank you so very much. I have a number of testifiers here, and I'm going to turn it over to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please state your name and proceed.
Good evening. Good evening. My name is Julie Brecky. I'm the executive director at HIRED. Thank you, Chair Mahoney and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak to the importance of career pathways and specifically the Pathways to Prosperity competitive grant round. I know that there is an attachment in your packet that gives some information.
Looks like that.
Representative Mahoney has put together. And I, knowing, again, the hour at nearly 9:10, I will aim to keep my comments brief. I do want to say that we're just honored to have the chance to speak to the importance of the Career Pathway Program. At Hired, we've actually been doing this work. We were an early adopter. Our first Career Pathway Program was in manufacturing, all the way back in 2004, prior to the word Career Pathway even being coined, I believe. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Employment Services Consortium, MESC, a group of nonprofit employment service providers dedicated to improving the lives of low-skilled, low-income workers and meeting the workforce development needs of employers in the state's rapidly changing demographic environment. I will point out in the attachment that there is actually a list of MESC members that have signed on to supporting this bill. Hired is a multi-service workforce development nonprofit that offers life-changing programs to help individuals overcome employment barriers. Our programs help under- and unemployed individuals get a job, build a career, support their family, contribute to Minnesota's economy, and build a hopeful, stable future for their families. Hired has programs across the Twin Cities in Hennepin, Ramsey, and Dakota counties. Last year alone, we placed 2,424 individuals in jobs with an average wage of placement of $17.76 per hour, which is not an unusual rate of placement in the Career Pathway programs. I do want to just share that Hired envisions a community with empowered people and families, a prepared workforce, and an inclusive economy. And one of the ways we realize this vision is to collaborate with employers and education partners in offering career pathway programs. I have been fortunate to receive Pathways to Prosperity funding for the last few years. Presently, we have 5 career pathway programs in high-growth sectors, and P2P funds actually pay for a part of those training dollars. All of Career Pathway programs are free of charge and removing any kind of tuition barrier to low-income individuals. So we actually leverage P2P funds as well as philanthropy to ensure that these training programs are accessible. We do believe that Career Pathway programs really address DEED's priorities of addressing workforce shortages in high-growth sectors, as well as addressing disparities reduction in the working populace of the state. I want to give a bit of a success story. I'd like to highlight a public sector admin program that helps people with employment barriers assemble the skills they need to secure an office admin job in the public sector. That was appropriate, as one of our employer partners is the state of Minnesota. That's one of 6 different public sector employer partners that participate in this training program. And actually, Emma Curry served as an amazing internal ambassador, building credibility for the Career Pathway programs in different departments across the state. The state and some of the other public sector employers helped to shape the curriculum that we're preparing people for this to be career ready in an office job in the public sector. We do use a hybrid of employers' minimum hiring qualifications as our eligibility criteria as we screen people for these highly sought after training slots, actually. The training program is a 5-week training program for about 120 hours. It is followed by a 2-week job shadow that demonstrates what a career in administration can be, and it provides an employer partner the chance to see program participants in action, showcasing what a valuable team member they can be, what their skills, attitudes, and teamwork are. Our participants don't always look good on paper, and the job shadow showcases their strengths in a way that a resume may not be able to accurately portray. The training that the nonprofits and Hired is one of many nonprofits using the Career Pathway funds to do good in the community. We do provide wraparound support services, and that really is meeting individuals where they're at, removing barriers to those course completions so they can move into these jobs where we have motivated employer partners engaged at the table. What we know is that the Career Pathway Program works. There's a lot of different data out there, again, on the DEED dashboard. And actually, I'll just give you some stats from the public sector pathway that I talked about just a few moments ago. Last year, we held 3 classes. 41 individuals were enrolled. 39 graduated after a seven-week training program. It's not paid, but it's free. 32 individuals were placed in living wage jobs that we believe will lead to a career in the public sector. So that's 95% of the low-income individuals with a lot of employment barriers have reduced those and graduated, and 78% moved into a job in the public sector. Thank you for this opportunity to highlight the importance of career pathways. We hope that you will strongly advocate for the codification of Pathways to Prosperity program, and I'm happy to answer any questions or directly turn it over to Ellen Waters of MSP Gwynn.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Ellen Waters. I'm sitting here as the executive director of MSP Gwynn, which is a funders collaborative about 6 years old. That is a group of philanthropic entities that came together because they wanted to see better outcomes for employers and job seekers in the state of Minnesota from our workforce ecosystem, including the public sector workforce system. And we believe that this is an important bill. We have been strong supporters of career pathways, particularly those that lead to family-sustaining jobs. And you'll see evidence in your packet that Pathways to Prosperity participants tend to have better wages throughout their post-training careers than others. And we're really excited and want to see this program codified and funded. I can comment that I have been involved in workforce development for more than 20 years. I think I served with Representative Gunther when we merged the old DTED and the Department of Employment and Training a long, long time ago. And at that time, my time in workforce development, we've always struggled to find programs that were evidence-based, that had tangible outcomes that we could point to, that we could invest in. And I think Career Pathways, which has been receiving funding for the past several years, has really proven itself to be an important part of our state's approach to workforce and training, particularly because the outcomes for diverse individuals, people of color, and other underserved job seekers are especially strong through this Career Pathways approach. So we would like to see the guidelines that are here, the program codified, and we've included, or Representative Mahoney has included, some guidelines that afford some flexibility for the program to evolve along with the needs of our employers and our job seekers. And we would think that this is the best way to stimulate our state's workforce development program. So we would appreciate your support.
Thank you so much for the testimony. Do we have anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Don't see anyone. Any questions from members? Representative Robbins.
Sorry, I'm a big fan of this. I just wonder, why does it need to be codified? Wasn't this already an existing program at DEED?
Chair Mahoney.
I think they're misusing the word codify. I think what they're trying to do is put it into law. You're implying putting it into law. We've never put it into law. I don't believe this bill puts it into law. We fund it, and we fund it through a competitive grant.
So it's just continuing with what's been a past practice. It's not creating an...
We're just funding programs.
Okay. Thank you. And secondly... you mentioned several times about the public sector pathways. Are there private sector pathways as well?
Ms. Wark.
Yeah, absolutely. I can speak to that. I mean, I think one of the things in the best practice model that Ellen referred to is really working with employers and identifying where there's pinch points in entry-level and gateway positions. That's certainly happening in government. And, of course, I think any CEO, large or small, is dealing with how they're going to be dealing with the silver tsunami and a lot of different workforce shortages. And so I think the six high-growth sectors are IT, financial services, healthcare is number one. There's no doubt about that. Construction, what am I missing here? Public sector, actually, and I think there's one, manufacturing, yeah.
Manufacturing. Thank you.
And manufacturing.
And
last question. Representative Haley had to step to a different committee, but she asked me to ask if there also, this is in Greater Minnesota, did the dollars get all across the state?
Yes.
I believe that's true. Yes.
Chairman. Ms. Juarez.
This is a report from DEED on the last training program, and it funded 57 training programs statewide, and it does reach all four corners of the state.
Thank you.
Representative Song.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to say that I'm probably a co-author of this bill. Before getting elected here, I was actually working very close with Ms. Brecky on some of the workforce development and career pathway programs. So I didn't realize that you were here tonight because we were actually talking about this bill. I said, like, oh, look, my name's on there. I'm a co-author. And so I just wanted to assure that I've actually worked very close with Ms. Brecky and her organization, and I've seen firsthand the impact the work that they do for communities, and especially underserved populations. And I really appreciate all that your organization is doing, and I fully support this bill and look forward to seeing more work you have to offer for our communities.
Thank you, Representative Zhang.
Representative Hassan.
I did not have a question. Sorry.
Representative Beck.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. You mentioned, and I appreciate that, that you had 57 different centers and or outreach. Would you have information, or could you get it to me on proportionally where we're seeing where those are? Obviously, I'm more concerned in greater Minnesota than anything, but would really like to do that because my district, and I'm not saying that you've not been out there, I do not know, but there is a need when we get closer and closer to the Dakotas, and would like to see, and maybe there's something we can do to reach out, because we have a quite, you know, minority population with the Native Americans that I work with, and so forth. So we'd like to get that information, please.
Ms. Watt.
Thank you.
Seeing no any other question, Chair Mahoney, do you want to make your final statements and then you?
Well, I think Representative Zong said most everything I needed to say. The one thing I will add is that I've had the best luck in getting accountability data from this particular organization, this particular group, because it's not one organization here. And that is one of the nice things about this group, being able to go back to the dashboard and see what the people were making, how long they were in school or in training, what they were making when they came out, and what they were making months down the road. We are not that successful with all workforce training programs. And just to give everybody a hint, that next year we'll be doing a lot of work on trying to figure out an accountability system for the whole bunch, because we won't have this much money to spend. So I would like to make my motion, to renew my motion, to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, as amended.
As amended. So thank you so much, Chair. We have one more business to take care of. We haven't approved the minutes. Mr. Chair Mahoney moves the minutes for approval.
I have read the bill, read the minutes, and see no need for any changes, so I'd like to make the move. Motion.
The motion is to approve the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, see none. There's no any other business, so we adjourn.
Before you go, just remember we are all meeting again at 8 o'clock in the morning to finish up.
We'll be at 8 o'clock. So the meeting is adjourned.